Bigger than this girl who you said was your blood.
There was a long silence, and then Sophia rolled over again so that she was staring at the rafters.
And you still ain't said how, she said. I told you, I needed a how.
How, huh? I asked.
Yeah, how,
she said. Come on, I said.
What?
You said you wanted to know how. Well, you want to know, or you don't. By then I was climbing down the ladder. At the door I put on my brogans and wrapped myself in my fear-no-man coat. Looking back, I saw Sophia gazing at Caroline, still snoring lightly on Thina's bosom. Come on, I said. We walked along that route that had now become sacred to me. I had been practicing, experimenting as I could with the powers and reach of memory, so that when we arrived minutes later at the banks of the River Goose, I felt myself in control. I turned to Sophia and said, "You ready?" To this she rolled her eyes and shook her head. I took her hand, and in the other hand I clutched the wooden horse. And then I guided her down toward the banks, and as we walked I spoke of that night, that last holiday when we were all there together, and more than spoke it, I felt it, made it real to me. Conway and Cat, Philippa and Brick, Thina all wrathy in front of the fire.
Land, niggas, she said, land!
And I remembered then Georgie Parks, Amber, and their little boy. And I remembered the free ones, Edgar and Patience, Pap and Grease. And no sooner did I think of them than I felt Sophia jump with a start, squeeze my hand, and I knew then that it had begun. There was a bank of fog covering the river, and over top of it we saw them, phantoms flittering before us in that ghostly blue, the entire range of them who had been there on that holiday night. Georgie Parks was on his jaw harp, Edgar at the banjo, Pap and Grease were hollering, and all the rest circled and danced around the fire. We could hear them, not in our ears, but somewhere deep beneath the skin. It seemed that the bank of fog was alive, for its wispy fingers seemed to move in time with the music, seemed to stretch toward us and, on beat, gently induce us to join. It was a simple thing to accept the invitation. All that it required was a squeeze of that wooden horse. When I did this, those same fingers shot out, took hold of us, jerked us forward, and released us. I felt Sophia stumbling and grabbed a hold of her hand. When she'd recovered, she looked back at me, stunned. And then we looked out forward. We saw that the forest was in front of us, and the river, the bank of fog, and the phantoms were behind. Looking back across, we could see what happened. We'd been conducted across the river to the other side. Looking down, we saw the blue tendrils of mist retreating off of us, and we heard the music picking up again, louder and louder. Georgie still on the jaw harp, Edgar with his banjo, while the rest of them hollered and danced, and again we saw the fingers of fog reach for us, beckoning us with the beat. Now I pulled the wooden horse from my pocket and held it aloft, and it glowed blue in my hand. And I looked to Sophia, and then I squeezed again, and the mists shot out, snatched us up, and pulled us to the other side of the river. When we were released, Sophia stumbled and fell. I helped her up, and we returned again and heard the music rising and saw again the fingers of fog beckon. It's like dancing, I said. And I squeezed again, but this time Sophia leaned into the fog with all her weight, giving into it, riding it, so that she landed firm on her feet. I squeezed again, and we were again conducted. Squeezed again, and we were conducted. Squeezed again, and were conducted. Then, thinking of my old home with Thina and all my days there, and what it had been to me through all those years, I squeezed again, and the blue tendrils snatched us up, and this time, when they released us, we found ourselves right back there on the street. And as the fog retreated, the last image we had was of a woman water dancing, a jar on her head dancing away from us until, with the most incredible grace, she angled her head so that the jar slid down, and reaching up, she caught the jar by the neck, laughed, drank from it, and offered it up to someone unseen as she faded away. When we returned to the cabin, Sophia climbed up to the loft. I tried to follow, but collapsed back in a heap and crashed so loud that I woke Thina.
"Hell are y'all doing?" she yelled.
"Just out for some air," Sophia said.
"Air, huh?"
Thina said skeptically. Sophia reached down and helped me up the ladder, and when I got to the top, I collapsed into a dreamless sleep. I awoke early the next morning and dragged myself through my tasks. The night following, we were there, laid out in the loft as usual, in our late-night conversations. "Where'd you first see the water dance?" I asked.
"Don't even remember," Sophia said. "Where I'm from, everybody do it. Some better than others, but they start us on it young down there. It's tied to the place, you know?"
"I don't," I said. "Never knew where it came from."
"It's a story," she said. "Was a big king who came over from Africa on the slave ship with his people, but when they got close to shore, him and his folk took over, killed all the white folks, threw them overboard, and tried to sail back home. But the ship run aground, and when the king look out, he see that the white folks' army is coming for him, with their guns and all. So the chief told his people to walk out into the water, to sing and dance as they walked, that the water goddess brought them here, and the water goddess would take them back home. And when we dance as we do, with the water balanced on our head, we are giving praise to them who danced on the waves. We have flipped it, you see? As we must do all things, make a way out of what is given. Ain't that what you done last night? Ain't that what you say you do? Flipped it? It's what Santy Best done, ain't it? She all I could think about when we came back up out of it last night. That king, the water dance, Santy Bess, you. It's like dancing. Ain't that what you said? It's what Santy Bess done. She ain't walk into no water. She danced, and she passed that dance on to you. And that's why they came for you, the underground," she said.
"Yep," I said. I had done it before, but not of my own deciding, and they had caught wind of me and had been watching me. And then after Maynard, well,
that's how it happened, huh? That's how you come up out of the goose? That's how you taken us up out of Loch Ness?"
"It is," I said, "but there is a problem, one I do not yet quite have figured. The thing works on memory, and the deeper the memory, the farther away it can carry you. My memory of that holiday night is tied to Georgie, and it's tied to this horse that was my gift to him and his baby. But to conduct y'all that far, I need a deeper memory, and need another object tied to that memory to be my guide.
How about that coin you used to always carry?"
"Yeah, I done tried that. It can't carry me far enough. One thing to cross a river, whole nother to cross a country. Gotta be deeper." Sophia was quiet for a moment, and then she said,
"That's quite the power. Gotta be that you are a man of some importance to this underground."
"That's what Corrine say."
"And this is why she won't let you loose."
"It's more than that," I said, "but that is the larger part of it."
"So then, Hiram," she said, "what is your intention toward me, toward my Caroline? What is our life to be?"
"I don't know," I said. "I figured I'd get you set up somewhere, and I could see y'all from time to time."
"No,"
she said.
"What?" I said. "We not going," she said.
"Sophia, it's what we wanted. It's why we was running."
"We, Hiram," she said. "We. You understand?"
"I would like nothing more than to go with you, to leave it all back here, but you must see why I cannot. After all I have told you, after what I have shared of this war that we find upon us, you must see why I can't leave."
"I am not telling you to leave. I am saying that we, my Carrie and me, we are not leaving without you. I have lived here so long watching these families go to pieces, and here I have formed one with you, with a man who is as you have said yourself, blood of my Caroline? She is your kin, and I know it is a horrible thing to say, but I am telling you, you are her daddy, more of a daddy than that girl would ever have.
You know what you're saying, I said.
Do you know what you are walking away from? No, she said, but one day I will, and when I do, I will know it with you.
I felt in that moment something low and beautiful, something born down here on the street and all the streets of America, something nurtured and birthed out of the Warrens. It was the warmth of the muck. It was the relief of the low-born, the facing of the facts, the flight from quality, the gravity and excrement of the true world where we all live. I turned away to sleep and felt Sophia pulling close to me and slipping her arm underneath mine until her hand found the warm, soft part of me. You know, you're chaining yourself to something here. And for a while, the only answer was the soft, warm breath on the back of my neck, and then she said,
"Ain't a chain if it is my choosing."
The next day, Thina and I went out on our route, collecting the washing, and then we spent the next hauling up the water and tubs, beating the jackets and trousers, and then hanging them in the drying room down in the Warrens. Sophia was not with us, pleading illness on behalf of Caroline. But there was no illness, it was part of a plan. One that was ill thought, for now, at the end of the day, with our hands worn and our arms exhausted. Thina was ornery at her absence.
"What is wrong with her, hi?" Thina said.
We were walking slowly back down to the street. The sun had faded long ago, and we moved like shadows down the path, past the orchards and through the woods.
"I wish you had chosen a girl with more back to her. That Sophia don't know nothing about work."
"She worked just fine," I said. "She worked for you while I was gone."
"If that is what you must call it," Thina said. "Way I see it, she only start really doing it once you was here. How you gonna make away with a woman like that, hi? All that's put on a man's life? How you gonna get it done with a woman who only worked for show? When I was young, I outworked every man on the home place, everyone, even mine. I was terror in the tobacco fields, and I kept house too. Of course, I sometimes wonder what it all got me, cracked over the head and robbed of my little stack of freedom. So, maybe that girl knows something I do not."
"I seen Kessia," I said. All day, I had tried to weave this announcement somehow into our conversation. I had failed at discovering some decorous way to accomplish this, and knowing that it had to be done, I elected for the most direct route. Thina stopped and turned to me.
"Who?"
"Your daughter," I said. "Kessia. I seen her."
"Is this you being mad for what I said about that girl?"
"I have seen her," I said, as firm as I could muster.
"Where?" said Thina.
"North," I said. "She lives just outside Philadelphia. Was taken to Maryland after she was stripped from you. From there, escaped north. She got a family, a husband, who was good to her."
"How?"
"She want you to join her," I said. "She want you up there with her. Thina, this ain't no joke. When I left her, I told her I would get you back to her. I promised, and I now mean to honor that promise."
"Honor? How?"
And there in the forest, as I had done with Sophia, I explained what had happened to me and what I had become.
"So this is the underground?" she asked.
"It is," I said, "and it ain't."
"Well, which is it?"
"It's me," I said. "It's me, and I'm asking if you can hold to that."
"Kessia?"
she asked of no one in particular.
"Last time I seen her, she was such a small thing. Willful as hell. She loved her daddy, you know. And he was so very hard. We used to have camellias.
It was another time. Another time. She would go out back and picking them until I...
She paused here, and her face took on a look of confusion.
Cassia,
she said softly. And then the tears came, slow and silent, and without a cry or wail. She said her daughter's name again, and then she turned to me and asked,
Did you see any of the others?
I shook my head and said, I am sorry. And that was when the wailing came, and was low and deep and throaty, and she moaned to herself, Oh, Lord! Oh, Lord! And shook her head.
Why you bring this back to me? Why you do this? You and your underground. Hell, I care! I have settled up with it. Why you bring this to me?
Thina, I...
No, you done spoke, let me speak. Do you know what I done? And you should have known. You who I took in, you bring this back to me. You do this to me in this very house where I took you in when you wasn't spit, and you come down here and do this to me. Do you know what it took for me to make peace with this?
She was backing away from me now, backing her way out of the cabin. Thina,
no. No, you stay away from me. You and your girl, y'all stay away from me.
She ran out into the night, and I chased after her. Tried to take her arm, she shook me off, elbowing, punching, and wrenching her way loose.
Stay away, I say,
she yelled.
Stay away. How dare you bring me back like this? Stay as far from me as you can, Hiram Walker. You are done to me.
I should not have been surprised. I knew by then how much the past weighs upon us. I knew this more than anyone. I knew men who had held down their own wives to be flogged. I knew children who'd watched those men hold down their mothers. I knew children who rooted through slop with hogs. But worst of all, I knew how the memory of such things altered us. How we could never escape it. How it became an awful part of us. And I must have known this in my young years. Why else that memory of my mother, taken and shut up in a lockbox? So, who was I in that moment, watching Thina disappear into the night, to begrudge her desire to forget? Oh, I understood it all. I walked back into that cabin, and sat there, silent, for long hours, knowing how well I understood Thina's rage. And all night I turned this over, until lying there with Sophia and young Caroline between us, I knew what must be done. Cassia would always be a souvenir of what Thina had lost, of what was taken, so that to see her daughter again, Thina must remember. And I knew that I could in no way ask this of her if I were not prepared to do the same myself. Chapter 33. Early the next morning, I rose, drew up water for the washing, and cleaned myself. Walking up to the White Palace in those small hours, I thought of all the pieces that had been assembled before me, the breadcrumbs along the road. I thought of that old African king who had flipped it and danced into the waves as my grandmother had done, and with the water goddess's blessing, danced his people back home. And what did it mean that I saw my mother there that night with Maynard, dancing on the bridge, patting Juba, dancing over and under the water, flipping it? Even if Thina came around and decided to go, it would take a powerful memory to move her. So that morning, after serving my father breakfast and taking him out for a survey of the property, while he rested in the parlor, I walked up into his study, where he kept his correspondences, and scrawled a few lines in care of the Philadelphia Underground. I had to be careful, of course. I made use of a local alias, and directed my missive to one of our safe houses on the southern docks of the Delaware. And by code and misdirection, let it be known to Harriet what I would now be attempting. I do not know what I then expected. And more, I did not know, even with family in the balance, what side Harriet might take in the struggle. But she had said that should I find myself in need, I was to make it known. And I had done so. With that done, I went and collected my father and went with him through his various correspondences, almost all of them now originating in the West. His eyes and hands had by then grown much too weak, so I read them aloud, took down his responses, and then prepared them all to be sent out. When that was done, we walked back to his room, and I helped him change into a suitable set of work clothes. After this, I went down into the Warrens and changed into my overalls, and met him in the garden out behind the house, and together, with spade and fork, we worked until the sun had just begun its descent. We walked inside, changed again, and then I served my father his afternoon cordial, and as was his tradition, he soon fell fast asleep. It was now time. I walked upstairs, and then into my father's study, and looked at the mahogany highboy, and thought back again with shame to Maynard's game of rummaging among things that were not his own. It was an absurd shame. Nothing in this house, on this land, indeed on this earth, could be called the rightful property of Howell Walker. And yet, being quality, being a pirate, this never stopped him from laying claim. It was only natural that Maynard do the same. Perhaps I should too. When I pulled at the small bottom drawer and saw the ornate rosewood box, its silver clasps gleaming, I cannot say I knew what was inside. But when I rubbed my hands over the top of the box, I sensed that should I choose to open it, nothing could ever be the same again. And so it was. What I saw was a necklace of shells, and in an instant I was sure that it was the same necklace that I had seen the night my brother died, shaking from the neck of the dancer, shaking from the neck of my mother. And what I did now was bring the necklace to me, reaching behind my own neck to put it on. And when the hook and eye clasp locked into place like a lost jigsaw, a wave rippled out through my fingers, through my wrists and arms, into the deepest part of me, so that I stumbled back. When I regained myself, I knew that the wave, which was only then subsiding, was the force of memory, the memory of my mother. And now, all that I had known as the words of others formed into portrait and pictures, the fog and smoke of my years, blew away, so that I saw my mother in full form, in all our short years together, and too, I saw her end. And I saw exactly how that end had come, and I saw precisely who had brought it about. I tell you, it took all of my restraint to not rush down those stairs and into the garden where the spade and fork were still planted in the cold ground, pull them out, and relieve my father of that brief splash of life that remained in his mortal vessel. And that I did not is only testament to what I felt then at stake, to those whom I loved, who I then knew were counting on me to remember, and to remember I had to live. I closed the box and shoved it back into the highboy. Then I tucked the necklace of shells under my shirt. I walked back downstairs and saw that my father was now awake, and looking out the window, I could see that evening was upon us. It occurred to me then that what felt like mere seconds had been much longer. I went out to the kitchen and saw that my father's meal was being prepared, and remembered that he was not to be dining alone that evening. I walked up the first course, bread and terrapin soup, and found waiting there at the dinner table, with my father, Corrine Quinn. She never betrayed anything that evening, but at the end, as they repaired to the parlor for tea, she mentioned to me that she believed Hawkins wished a word with me. I walked outside and down to the stables, well anticipating what he would have to say. Hawkins was tied to the Virginia Underground, and thus to the word of Corrine Quinn. It was her figuring, no doubt, that if she could not stop me, perhaps someone who had once seen the world as I had would make me understand. It was now late. The air was crisp and cold. A bright moon hung high in the sky. I found Hawkins seated inside the chaise, puffing on a cigar. When he saw me, he smiled and held out his hand to offer me a seat. "I know why you're here," I said. "Ain't nothing you can say to change what's coming." "Huh?" he said. Then he reached into his pocket and said, "My only notion was to offer you a cigar." "That ain't your only notion," I said. "Nah, it's not." He handed me the cigar. "My feeling is that I have been hard with you," he said. "It is by virtue of my position, but it is also by cause of what I have seen and how I come to the position. You understand that me and my Amy, we were pulled out by Corrine? Yes?"
"I do."
"And you know that we was at Bryston before she came?"
I nodded.
"Then I guess all I want you to know is how much hell passed on that place. It was not the normal small stepper. It was not just the task. Edmund Quinn was the meanest white man this world has known, and I am convinced of it. And you see how it is now. You see how Bryston put on a face whenever the quality is about. Look like Virginia of old, don't it? And then when they are gone, we are back to our business. Bryston always been that way, two-faced. But Edmund Quinn's business was different. Many years I watched him pose as a man of God and honor, toasting at the socials, sending his money to the almshouse, money made off our backs. Forgive me, Hiram, but I cannot speak of what he did. What I will say is that it was such that I would have done anything to be out from under him, to save me and mine from that man's wrath. And that chance only came from Corrine Quinn. I am thankful for Corrine, I truly am. Thankful for what she done for my sister and me, for all and every soul that come through the Virginia Underground. Ain't too much I would not do in her service. For it was her plotting that rid us of that demon and more, put us upon this new task of ridding the greater demon he served. Hawkins leaned back and puffed on his cigar so that the tip glowed orange against the dark, and wisps of white smoke flowed out.
"So when she come to me and say that one of our own, who was brought out of the task, as so many have been brought out, was now planning to go against her, to go against us, and she asked me to speak to him and prevail upon him with truth and wisdom, I could only oblige."
"Ain't no point," I said. "You don't know what I seen." But he kept talking as though I had not spoken.
"I seen a lot of folks come through that Virginia station, and ma'am, do they ever and always bring their troubles right along. Nothing ever go as it should on rescue. You seen it yourself. Bland into Alabama, that fellow who brought his girl with him last year, you know what I mean? It never play out like you draw and figure it. And when you out here in the field, it can be hard on you when folks do not act as you need them. Well, take you, for instance. What we heard was that you would be the one. You would open the door. You would snap your finger or twitch your nose and whole plantations would vanish."
Hawkins laughed to himself.
"Well, ain't quite work out as such."
"I have tried," I said. "I have done." But once again, he talked through me.
"But I think this is the lesson in it all. We forget sometimes. It is freedom we are serving. It is the task that we are against. And freedom mean the right of a man to do as he please, not as we suppose. And if you have not been as we supposed, you have been as you were supposed to be."
Now Hawkins was silent for a moment, and we sat there and smoked, the cool, crisp wind blowing through us.
"I don't know what you done seen, Hiram. I don't know what happened to them folks you bent on bringing out. And I would like to tell you very much that what you are doing is not what I would do.
but I cannot speak as such in any righteous way, for who can say what I would have done to bring myself out, to bring out my Amy? You are free, and must act according to your own sense. Can't be according to mine, can't be according to Corrine.
Don't matter none, I said. Looked like they don't want out anyway.
Hawkins laughed quietly.
Yes, they do, he said. Everybody do. Ain't a matter of if they want out. All want out of this. It's just a matter of how.
That following Sunday, I met Thena early that morning to deliver the washing, which was folded and boxed in crates. We did the rounds in silence, and when I returned the chaise and tied up the horse, she walked off without a word. I followed her up into the tunnel and found her in her old room, where she'd been living for the past week.
"Well?"
she asked sardonically, looking up at me. "So, that's it, is it?" I said.
"Seem like it."
"All right," I said, and walked down to the street. But the next day, when I came up from my dealings with my father, she was waiting there just before the secret staircase that led out of the Warrens into the upper house. I could see by the lantern light that she had been crying. When she saw me, she shook her head and wiped her cheeks.
"It's a lot to put on anyone, High. It is a weight, a whole other task."
"I know," I said. "I have seen it all now, remember it all now, and I know."
"Do you?" she said. "Because I do not think you do. I think you know your end of it, which is the end of the child stripped from the bosom. But do you know the other side of things? Do you know how hard it was for me to love you as I did, Hiram? To be in that space again after what had been done to my Silas, my Claire, my Aram, my Alice, my Kessia? It was so very hard. But I seen you up in that loft looking down, and I knew that mine's was never coming back, and yours was never coming back. And if we had nothing between us, at least we had that. And I did love you, High. I did go back into that room, and when you left me there, when you run off with your girl, I cried myself to sleep every night for a month. I was so very afraid for what they would do to you. I could hardly believe it. I had lost another one, but not even to the task. And so it must be me. Something in me that pushed everything I love away. It tore me up, something awful. Then you come back. Except you do not come back alone. You come back with stories. Stories from that room where I was violated and trespassed upon. And now you are telling me that I have to go back. What will I say to her, High? What will I be? What will I do when I look at her and all I can see are my lost ones?"
Her head was in her hand, and she was weeping softly and quietly. I pulled her to me and put her head in my chest, and we held each other there, and so began the countdown of our last hours at Lochless. We could have in no way remained, not at Lochless as it was, nor at Lochless as we believed it to be becoming. Sophia had protections now, the protections of Corrine, who, for whatever her demerits, had always been true to her word. But for Thena, the advance of age and the assault upon her propelled matters forward in my mind. My father was by then so much in the dealing and trading of his people, doing all that he could imagine to stay afloat and dodge the debtors that seemed to swarm all around him. He could not continue as such, and he would not, though I did not know that then. But even if I had, there was a promise I had made to Kessia, and I was determined then to make it good. I waited 2 weeks for some reply from Harriet, but receiving none, I deduced that I could expect no assistance, a fact to which I could muster no rage nor disquiet. I had been with the underground only a year, and knowing the intensity of the work, I understood the need to preserve allegiances. I was on my own then, an underground station all to myself. I had done it in the smallest way on the banks of the Goose, but to conduct as the old African king, as Santi Bess, as Moses, seemed fantastic. I had my memories, though, all of them, and I had the object by which I hoped to focus the energies of those lost-found years. Our last night altogether was the coldest of that season. It was a Saturday, so picked because it would give a day for me to recover myself and be back at my duties on Monday, arousing no suspicion. We gathered together what we would then have considered a feast: ash cake, fish, salt pork, and collards. We ate quietly together and then sat in the cabin where Thina had returned. And now Thina amused Sophia with stories of her own youth, and much laughter passed on this account. And then the hour came upon us. There was a hurried goodbye. I told Sophia to wait for me back at the quarters, and were I not back by dawn, for her to look for me down by the riverbanks. Outside the cabin, I looked up into the night, which was big and clear, the moon bright as a goddess, the stars, all her progeny, all her fates, and dryads and nymphs, spread out across the cosmos. Then I held Thina's hand and walked with her out from the cabin, through back paths of the woods, the earth snapping and crunching beneath us, until we were at the banks of the River Goose. I had not told Thina what to expect. I did not know how I could. All she knew was that I had found the route of Santi Bess, and that Sophia had testified to its truth. So it was understandable that right here, Thina, holding tight to my hand, stopped in her tracks, and when I turned to her, I saw that she was looking up. And when I followed her stunned gaze, I saw that the night sky that had moments before been so big and bright was now obscured by clouds. Wisps of white fog were now coming up off the river, which was only evidenced by the sound it made gently washing up against the shore. The necklace of shells was warm against me. And on we walked, taking a southern route along the banks until the wisps, rising gently off the river, began to congeal into a stew of fog. And over top of it all, we saw, looming in the darkness, the bridge that had carried so many of us, Natchez Way. We had gone the back way to avoid Ryland, which, even in its diminished and infiltrated capacity, still haunted the county. Now we circled around until we were at the bridge's approach, and looking out, I saw that the fog had thickened so that it seemed the clouds had fallen and enveloped everything. But not everything. For in the distance, rising up from where the water must have been, or where the water used to be, I could see the blue glow of halos all around, ringing out like memory. And now I felt the necklace burning underneath my shirt, burning bright as the North Star. I pulled the thing out so that it was over my shirt. It was time. "For my mother," I said. "For all the so many mothers taken over this bridge from which there can be no return." And then I looked at Thina, and I saw now she was softly illuminated in blue light emanating from the necklace of shells. "For all the mothers who have remained," I said, with one hand clasping hers and the other on her cheek, "who carry on in the name of those who do not return." I turned back to the bridge now and began to walk, and as I did, saw the tendrils of fog lapping over the bridge and the blue lights dancing softly in the distance on what would have been the far end, though I knew that night that no such end would be our destination. "Thina," I said, "my dear Thina, I have told you much about me, but I have never revealed the essence of all that has guided me, for all of it has been for so long tucked away, hidden in a fog as thick as what surrounds us. It had to be as such, for I was too young to bear what happened, too young to survive with the memory. You know that my mother is Rose, and my father is Howell Walker. I was the product of their outrageous union. I was not alone. My brother Maynard was born 2 years before me, to the Lady of Lochless, and it was believed that his blood carried all that was good and noble of the old place, and he should some day make for a wise and careful heir. For the blood was magic, science, and destiny. But I defied the blood, and so defied destiny. And I think now, knowing all I know, that it was my lost mother who made it so. For so long, I could not see, could not remember, but I see it all now. Her bright, joyous eyes, her smile, her dark red skin, and I remember her stories of the world that was, stories brought across from water, stories she would share only at night before bed if I had been a good boy that day. I remember how the stories glowed in my mind, how they filled our nights with colors. I remember Kufi, who tucked the drum into his bones, and Mammy Wata, who lived in that paradise under the sea, where we would all arrive after our task and find our reward. And now the fog gathered around us, and I felt the bridge disappear under my feet. Thina still had my hand, and I could feel the heat pushing out from the shell necklace all around me, and the waves that once marked the river were quiet and low. But Kufi, with the drum tucked into his bones, was in the now time, in the midst of the task, and my mother had the drum beating in each and every one of her bones. There were stories when she danced, maybe more true than stories in her words. I remember her patting Juba with her sister Emma, how the shell necklace would shake, how the jar of water stayed fixed upon her head, and those were the good years under the task. But the task is the task. And I do believe my mother, my Aunt Emma, danced as they did because they knew what good there was could not last. And at this they came, the phantoms that I had seen flittering about that fateful evening. They were all around us, and I could see that it was holiday, a holiday I remembered when I was 5, and it was still the high times of Elm County, and Howell Walker had sent demijohns down to the street. And down near the bonfire I saw them, my mother and my Aunt Emma, trading dances back and forth. I stopped here and watched, for though the moment was conjured up by me, I wanted to savor it. But when I tried, I saw them begin to fade from me, fade like mortal life and mortal memory, and I knew that I must keep telling the story. The world changed. Tobacco fell. I remember the strange men with their worried faces. I remember the soil now hard, and the old manses along the goose left to possums and field rats. And I remember that there were fewer uncles about, that cousins were off on long jaunts that did not end. And I remember how we were conducted over the bridge off to Natchez. And I remember because I was there. And now, where the phantoms had once danced before us, we saw that these same men and women were walking before us. And where they had once worn looks of great joy, there was now sorrow and a longing in their eyes, deep as the river itself. And where their arms and their legs had once been dancing, I saw now that from ankle to wrist, they were chained. I remember my mother kneeling at my bedside, waking me and carrying me off into the night. And for 3 days and nights we lived out in the forests among the animals, sleeping by day and running by night. And all she would say to me was that we must go, for we end up like Aunt Emma. And though I was young then, I understood that my Aunt Emma had been sold. If we could get to the swamps, that was her aim, to get us there, to get us away, for she could not run across the water like her mother. But they ran us down, Ryland did, caught us and brought us back, and we were held in their jail in Starfall. I was there with my mother, and I could not wholly understand. And so lost was I that when my father came, I truly believed he had come bringing salvation. He was so soft, Thina. He held his hand on my cheek, and when he looked at my mother, he was pained. "Why did you go?" he asked. "What have I ever done to push you so?" But there was only silence in my mother's regard. And when he asked her again, still she would not speak. And I saw then that his pained look twisted into a rage. And what I then knew was that my father's pain was not for my mother nor for me, but for himself. For my mother had seen him, had seen through all the noble facade, and she knew what he was. This was what her flight meant, that she understood that he would sell her, as sure as he would sell her sister, as sure as he would sell his own son. My father walked away, and my mother understood. She took the necklace of shells from her neck and handed it to me, and she said to me, "No matter what shall happen, you are remembered to me now. Forget nothing of what you have seen. I am soon a ghost to you. I have tried best I could to be as a mother should, but our time has now come." And then my father came back with the hounds, and they pulled me away from her, yelling, crying, pulled me from my mother and left her there to be sold off, while I was to be taken back to Lochless. And now, for the first time in our journey, I experienced Thina as a weight upon my arm. It was the oddest thing, as though some force were trying to pull her from my arm and drag her back into the hole. The words I spoke were a power. We did not so much walk as float across the fog. I felt the heat in my chest and the blue shine of light pushing out. I could not let go. We returned to Lochless with a horse, for that is what he traded Rose for. He had taken my mother from me, but it was not enough. He took my memory of her too, for when we left, my father, in more rage than I had ever seen in him, he took the shell necklace from me. And I ran from him. And the next morning I ran down to the stables where I saw the same horse my mother had been traded for, and there by the trough of water I felt my first inclination of what I give to you now. Conduction. I sat there in the stables, crying. An ache filled me until my skin tore apart, my bones popped from their sockets, and my small muscles ripped at the tendons. I clinched to hold myself in, but a wave roiled through me, carried me out the stables, past the orchard, past the field, back to my cabin. The pain of memory, my memory so sharp and clear, was more than I could bear, so that this one time I forgot, though I forgot nothing else. I forgot my mother's name, forgot my mother's justice, forgot the power of Santi Bess, of Mammy Wata, and turned my eyes to the great house of Lochless. Now a ripping feeling overtook my body, and Thina was such a weight that I felt as though my arm would be torn away, and all around me was fog and blue light. So many gave me the word, but they could not give memory. They could not give story. My words were halting before me now, and I felt us sinking back, sinking into something, into the fog. But I shall remain, and Sophia shall remain, and the child Caroline shall know the North Star, which... And then I had no words. The heat in my chest stamped them out, and I felt as though we had been hurled from a cliff. And as I fell, a sheaf of memories fell around me like leaves in yellow September. I'm eating ginger snaps under the willow. Sophia is passing me the demijohn. Georgie Parks is telling me not to go. I am falling down. Then a voice came from out of the fog, for as the light dimmed in me, I could see another, green and bright, call out from the distance.
"Which holds that no man shall spread his net in the sight of birds, which we are high, though we were taken from our eyrie and installed in the Valley of Chains."
Then I was floating again. Thina had my hand.
"What is this?" she yelled into the fog.
The green light came closer and answered,
"It is conduction, friend. It is the old ways which shall and do remain."
I looked into light and saw her there, Harriet, clutching her walking stick, and holding her other hand was, my God, Kessia.
"I am sorry for the late hour, Hiram Walker," said Harriet, "but it took some doing."
I could not speak. I felt her words were a rope from which I now dangled. I looked to the way where Harriet had come. I saw amidst the fog the Delaware docks.
"It's all right, baby boy,"
Cassia said. Go back. We have her now. It's all going to be all right. There was more, I assure you. But I cannot describe the fatigue and pain that was then upon me. I would like to give you some final notion, some look upon Thina's face at the reunion with her daughter recovered from among the lost, but I was then falling again, tumbling amidst all the memory of my life, tumbling back through years, through Makaja Bland's and Mary Bronson's, tumbling through my many lives, through free lovers and factory slaves, tumbling past Brothers White, tumbling back into the world. Chapter 34. I awoke in a stranger's bed, and like the morning a year ago when I had been conducted into the river with Maynard, all my muscles felt weighted. I looked over and saw sunlight peeking through the drawn blinds. I was in that rattled and confused state that one so often finds oneself having just awakened, but slowly the memories of that night came back to me. Thina was gone. I stood, and wanting to know the hour, walked gingerly over to the blinds, pulled at the rod, and brought in the sun. It was a blaring and bright January morning. When I turned to walk away, I fell to the floor, and likely would have lain there had Hawkins not then come through the door.
"Carried her off, did you?" he said.
He was reaching down to help me back to the bed. I managed to sit and felt life returning to my legs.
"Carried her right off," he said again.
I rubbed my eyes, then craned my neck toward Hawkins and said, "How?"
"Likely you know better than me," he said.
"No, how?" I said again. "How did I get here?"
"Your girl called on us," he said. "Your Sophia. Say she found you just outside her cabin yesterday morning, shivering on the cold ground, fevered and mumbling. She sent for us in Starfall. We knew, talked to Howell, said you should be brought into town for treatment, of course."
"Of course."
"You know, we had no angle on what you might say in your condition, who you might speak to and who it might come to. So we thought to keep you here, which was a good thought because this Thina is gone, and though Howell is not precisely aware of all events, he will take notice. And it is the oddest thing how her vanishing do match up well with your fevers. But we know nothing of it, do we? Not even here, because ain't no way you had anything to do with that. No way you would countermand Corrine. No way you would endanger the Virginia Underground."
"No way," I said.
"Just what I thought. Soon as you feel fit, you may dress yourself and tell Corrine that directly."
By evening, I felt somewhere close to myself. I dressed and walked down to the common room of the Starfall Inn. At a far table, there were three men, agents, enjoying an ale. At the far end of the common room, a barkeep stood in conversation with Corrine, who was just then laughing at some joke or story. She was in her lady clothes, face paint, balloon dress, and purse. I stood at the edge of the room, just by the staircase, watching her for a moment, wondering why her, what was it in Virginia or in the North that had so awakened the spirit of revolution? And what was it that would make this woman, this lady, who had it all, risk it all? I looked out on the common room, marveling at what Corrine had managed right there in the heart of Starfall, taking root right there in the heart of slavery. Presently she looked over and saw me, and the mirthful look faded. She nodded toward a table by the fire. We walked over, and as we were sitting down, she said,
"So, you have done it."
I did not answer.
"You need not reply. We knew what you were, and the possibility of such a thing has long been told since the stories of your grandmother. Hawkins knew."
"I did not," I said, "and it ain't worked quite how I wanted it. But she is gone." "She's gone," I said.
"I don't like it," said Corrine. "It is a problem. I must be able to depend on my agents. I have to know their minds."
I shook my head and laughed. "Do you ever hear yourself?" She was silent for a moment and then smiled.
I do, she said, I do. But I need reminding every now and again.
I don't doubt you, I said. But my grandmother, Santy Bess, she was before all of this, and this conduction, it belongs to something older than the underground. And as sure as I must be loyal to you, I have got to be loyal to that.
And the other girl, this Sophia, will you conduct her too?
I will be loyal to her, I said. That is what I can say. Loyal to what she has done for me. This, the second time she saved me. I cannot forget what I am working for, and there can be no distance between what I am working for and who I am working for. The barkeep brought over two warm ciders. The agents were still in their chatter. I drank from mine and said, "These people are not cargo to me. They are salvation. They saved me, and should I be presented with any instance where I feel I must save them, I will do it."
"Well, then, we'll just have to make sure no such instance arises," Corrine said.
"And how will you do that?" I asked. "We are here in the heart of it, in the maw of the beast. Even with you having her title, what more could possibly be done?" Now it was Corrine's turn to be silent. And this she did, drinking from her cider and staring out on the common room, marveling at her own work. It took another year to understand what Corrine's cryptic meaning was, but I think now I should have seen the outlines of it all the time. My father died the following fall, and at his inquest the facts of his last days became clear. He had driven Lockless completely into debt, but had been rescued by Corrine Quinn under the stipulation that the entire manse and all who remained within its borders become her property. And so the month after he died, we began a transformation of the property so that it resembled in form and function Bryston, which is to say on its face an estate of old Virginia, but on its interior a station on the underground. We arranged to have the few remaining tasked quietly dispersed into the country of upstate New York, New England, and some areas of the Northwest where underground men had their share of land. And with each of these sent out, we replaced them with agents, who continued their work throughout the state and even farther into those states that bordered. To the outside world, it was Corrine's property. But the stewardship of the estate fell to me. It is not how I imagined, but there I was, putative lord of the manor, agent for the Lockless station. 2 days after Thena's departure, Hawkins drove me back up to Lockless. It was evening when we arrived, and my father was being served his supper. I looked in on him, and he smiled. "All better now, are you?" he said. I leaned down low next to him, so that the cowrie-shell necklace, which I still wore, shook a little and fell out from under my shirt. "Better," I said to my father. I did not bother to look at him as I said this. I was not interested in his response. But I wanted him to know that I now knew all that he knew, that to forgive was irrelevant, but to forget was death. Then I walked down to the far end of the street. I found Sophia in the cabin, over the fire preparing supper. Carrie was on the bed, pulling gently at the cover and calling out various infant nothings. When Sophia saw me, she smiled, walked over, and kissed me softly. Then, while she finished dinner, I played with Carrie. We ate together in the far corner, the same corner where I once ate with Thena. I held Carrie on my lap and pulled off small bits of ash cake for her. Sophia just sat there watching us for a moment, smiling, and then she ate. We all slept up in the loft that night, for even though Thena was gone, it felt somehow proper to respect and observe her place in the house. Halfway through the night, we were still awake. Sophia was looking up at the gabled ceiling with Carrie asleep on her bosom. I had my fingers in Sophia's thick hair, gently twisting the strands into nothing in particular. "So, what about us?" I asked. "What are we now?" Sophia shifted Tarry off her bosom so that the baby lay between the two of us, and turned on her side until she was facing me.
"We are what we always were," she said. "Underground."
Author's note. The story of the White family takes the real-life saga of William and Peter Still and their family as its inspiration. You can read more about their story and the stories they collected from the formerly enslaved in a new edition of William Still's The Underground Railroad Records, edited by Quincy Mills, Modern Library. This is Joe Morton. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Water Dancer by Ta-Nehisi Coates. This program was directed by Lewis Milgram, executive producer Dan Musselman, text copyright 2019 by Ta-Nehisi Coates, production copyright 2019 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.